Welcome back to Clinicians Brief, the podcast, the conversations behind the content. I'm your host, Dr. Alyssa Watson, and today we're tackling a rather complex and nuanced topic of wellness care in patients that aren't really exactly well. So joining us for this conversation is Dr. Haley Lieber, an assistant clinical professor and oncologist at Oregon State University. You at home can find Dr. Lieber's article, which is entitled Top 5 Preventive Care Tips for Dogs and Cats with Cancer, in the July 2022 edition of Clinician's Brief. Hello, Dr. Lieber. Thank you for joining us today.
Hello. Thank you for having me on and letting me talk about some of these questions that are frequently asked of not only referring veterinarians, but some of our clients of pets with cancer.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really excited to talk about this topic with you today. But before we jump in, would you mind just introducing yourself briefly to the audience? We love to hear a little bit about your background, what got you interested in oncology.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm originally from a very small town in Oregon called Pendleton. People may be familiar with this town because it has a world famous rodeo, woolen mills, and even a whiskey brand as named after it. So you may have heard of Pendleton before. And I went to undergrad at Oregon State University, where I studied zoology in preparation for veterinary school. I then moved to California and worked at their veterinary teaching hospital in the oncology service while I was applying to vet school. And this is really where my passion for oncology started and kind of budded and grew from there. Following that, I moved to Southern California and went to vet school at the Western University of Health Sciences in Pomona. And following graduation, I completed a one-year rotating internship at Oklahoma State University. And then I moved back to Oregon to complete a oncology-specific internship, followed by a three-year medical oncology residency at OSU. And I was fortunate enough to stay on as a faculty member at the Carlson College of Veterinary Medicine here at Oregon State University, where I work as a faculty member and work in the veterinary teaching hospital to take care of all the pets with cancer, as well as teaching the next generation of veterinarians.
I think one of the things that I really found, you know, when I read this article was it was just a really good reminder that our patients are more than just their diagnosis. And after, you know, myself as a general practitioner, so I've been in practice a little over 19 years, it's really important to remember that we're still kind of a vital part of this patient's care, even after we have turned them over to a specialist or referred them on to care that we can't offer them, you know, in our own clinics. So the first component of preventive care that we're going to talk about today is vaccination. I mean, this is really core, right? Vaccination's often at the core of preventive care protocols for healthy patients. And this can be a real dilemma, you know, for practitioners. So what are the concerns out there? Like, what are the concerns about vaccinating patients if they're undergoing treatment for cancer, whether that be chemotherapy or radiation?
Yeah. There's a reason I chose this as the number one in this article. And that's because it's somewhat confusing and there's really multiple aspects to consider. On one hand, you know, we believe pets who are diagnosed with cancer and those that are receiving chemotherapy have weakened immune systems, so are kind of immunocompromised in one way. And this can actually dampen their ability to mount an appropriate antibody response following a vaccination, basically making that vaccine less efficacious if we were to give it to them. And then on the other hand, because they are immunocompromised, you know, it makes them more susceptible to acquiring these infectious diseases. So it kind of elevates their need for vaccine coverage or boosters. And I always talk about this with students too. Another thing to kind of contemplate or spend some time to consider is, if we are vaccinating a pet and stimulating their immune system, is this going to somehow alter the body's ability to combat or kill off the tumor? And I say this because we know dysregulation in the immune system is one of those hallmarks of cancer that a cell needs to exhibit a malignant transformation. So really, nothing's clear. It's very muddy water all around. So there's a lot of confusion around this topic, specifically as far as what's kind of required with vaccines in these cancer patients.
Sure. And I don't think that that confusion is, you know, isolated to veterinary medicine. I've seen this, you know, with family members that have undergone, that were undergoing chemotherapy, especially like when the COVID vaccine came out and people just didn't know. They didn't know what to do. Should we vaccinate? Should we wait? Is there literature? You know, what does the literature say about these concerns?
Yeah. There are a few, like a handful of articles out there on this topic in veterinary medicine. And I really urge the listener to read through those first few references that I list in the article that you talked about for more information on this. With that said, most of the data that we use clinically is extrapolated from our colleagues on the MD side of things. But it's really important to remember that our goals in veterinary oncology are vastly different than that in MD-based oncology. We're often using lower doses or less intense protocols and really focusing on quality of life, not quantity. And so I always ask myself, is it appropriate to extrapolate this information to our patients if we're not using the same doses and it's kind of related to these drugs? But in particular, I do want to highlight in one study, they looked at the effect of chemotherapy on the immune response in dogs with cancer. And the author found that chemotherapy may have less impact on T cell numbers and the ability to mount an antibody response than previously anticipated. And this could be a result of everything I just mentioned. Is it because we're using lower doses? Is it because we're using less intense protocols? Is there a species difference between humans and dogs and how they metabolize these drugs? Or does more research actually just need to be, you know, developed in this area? And related to that, they also found that a subset of these dogs were just relatively T cell deficient even before starting chemotherapy, which heightens or highlights that immunocompromised state we talked about. So there is some research, just not as much as on the human side of things.
Yeah. And I think, you know, as we, what we've been saying is this is just so nuanced and it's going to depend, you know, on each individual patient, as well as you definitely highlight in the article, you know, legal requirements. That's a whole separate thing, you know, for specific vaccinations, rabies vaccination and things like that, that are really vital to public health, you know, as well as to our patients. So, but just as a general rule, you know, if a practitioner does decide in a particular patient that vaccination, you know, is indicated, do you have any advice on timing? Like specifically, like, okay, so they're on a chemotherapy protocol every other week or every third week. Do you want to space that out from vaccination?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And individual oncologists may have different recommendations. So I urge listener to touch base with your local oncologist to start this dialogue on this very topic to figure out what's going to work well for you and them. But for our patients here at OSU, what we recommend is pausing any vaccine administration until the pet has completed their chemotherapy protocol. And we usually advise to wait at least 1 to 2 months after completion to allow the body ample time to replenish those circulating immune cells following chemotherapy before vaccinating the pet. And that's just to like let the bone marrow respond and get a good ample, you know, robust immune response that you're hoping for. Other considerations would be to perform vaccine titers, especially in our older patients who've maybe received multiple boosters throughout their lifetime, to kind of document, do these pets really need another dose or not? Or individualize the vaccine recommendations based on that pet's risk profile. So, you know, if they're a couch potato and not going to be out and exposed to leptospirosis, do we really need to be vaccinating for them, you know, on that routine basis? Kind of similar to the AHA recommendations for our non-core vaccine. So I think that there's some variation within there. And as you mentioned, there is some legal things that we need to consider, but all in all, I think it's kind of individual, and having those nuanced discussions with your oncologist and your client is the best bet.
So right after vaccination, the very next thing that always comes up is, you know, high in these preventive protocols is parasites. So fleas, ticks, heartworm. Me personally, I practice in Las Vegas, and so we are very lucky. We kind of have this isolated little valley where we're protected from these. We don't see a lot of fleas. We definitely don't see a lot of ticks. Maybe a smidge of heartworm, but even that, not much. And so there are all these products out there. There's just so many of them. And frankly, you know, I can't keep up with them. But I'm sure it's a question, you know, especially in other areas of the country where these parasites are just very, very prevalent that people have all the time. So are you aware of any concerns of using some of these common flea and tick medications? And then particularly, you know, there's a lot of talk lately about the isoxazoline category of flea and tick prevention. And so do you have any knowledge about any reactivity of those with animals receiving chemo?
Yeah, it's a really great question and a common one we get in the clinic. There's really limited evidence-based medicine related to this topic currently. So a lot of what I'm going to be talking about is anecdotal evidence that we know in our profession, and that is that it's safe. And many oncologists are going to advise pets to continue to receive these medications. And that's because the benefit to risk evaluation would suggest it's more advantageous for them to receive them and not develop these parasitic infections. And the reason I say that is that could complicate adverse event monitoring. If the pet develops, you know, a hookworm infection, is having diarrhea everywhere, is that because of the chemo drug or is it because he has a parasitic infection? That's very, very challenging. Also, you know, if you're going to have to treat these parasitic infections, you're adding to the list of medications the pet's already receiving, which can contribute to something that's becoming really more relevant in veterinary medicine and veterinary oncology, which is caregiver burden. You know, the client's having to intervene and then their relationship changes with that pet over time because of the amount of intervention. So I think these all kind of play a role in it. So not a lot of evidence-based medicine, but anecdotally, I can say that we're advising it, you know, to most pets to stay on flea and tick preventatives.
Sure. It's really good to hear that, you know, you feel like these things are very safe. Cause again, you know, that's the top priority, but yeah, I can imagine if you have an animal that's already has, you know, myelosuppression or something and is anemic or has low white count, then getting a parasitic infection on top of that can really complicate things and make them feel a whole lot worse.
Yeah.
You know? Heartworm prevention, again, not something that I have a ton of experience with all the different products out there. But just from a standpoint of, you know, again, looking at risk versus benefit, safety, efficacy, do you have any recommendations about the route? We definitely know there's products that are oral, there's products that are topical, there's products that are long-acting injectable. Does any of that make a difference in what you're recommending?
Yeah. Again, very interesting question, and not one I know an exact answer to. I can tell you again, anecdotal evidence, and what, you know, my colleagues and I here at OSU kind of recommend, and that's that we haven't really seen any difference. Obviously, clients come in with all different types of products that they're using on their pets, and I haven't really seen any differences or identified any patterns of unusual side effects or experience to date. And again, I think the benefit of these medications far outweighs that risk. So I don't have an exact answer, but I would imagine it probably wouldn't matter as far as route of administration.
And then what about elective anesthetic procedures? You know, this is another one commonly, you know, we'll have an animal that's being managed for their cancer, but they also have really significant dental disease, you know, and we think that it's causing them discomfort, maybe even have a broken tooth or something like that. I wouldn't exactly put that one in the category of elective. That might be a little bit more pressing, but just really, you know, really bad gingivitis, really bad periodontal disease, you know, a little mole or something that people want taken off. Where do you stand on those types of anesthetic procedures?
Yeah. I think it's important to think about it and potentially need to delay these or talk with your local oncologist about the timing of that. And the reason I say that is that I want to remind kind of the audience that conventional chemotherapy agents affect all rapidly dividing cells in the body. And because of this, we can see these innocent bystander effects, i.e. drops in our white blood cell counts, as well as gastrointestinal toxicity, such as nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. That's because those are normal rapidly dividing cells in the body. So these transient bone marrow suppressions and delayed wound healing can occur following chemotherapy. Therefore, timing of such elective procedures needs to be considered for any of these pets on a current chemotherapy protocol. And this is where a conversation with a specialist is really handy, because As you mentioned, sometimes these issues can be impacting more of their quality of life than the cancer diagnosis itself. And that's going to become a priority, right? And especially if we have their cancer disease under control, we may be able to either time our chemotherapy appropriately or give a small break to allow for these procedures to take place. And I think the dental is a classic example, because I've seen that numerous mm-hmm. times in my own patients, of where they have significant dental disease, where they are now having difficulty eating or just don't have as great of an appetite. And that affects, obviously, their quality of life. Their clients, have a hard time if their pet's not eating very well. And we find that, timing it appropriately so that they can get these procedures can be beneficial for everyone and really provide a better quality of life, which is our ultimate goal with oncology, right? Whether it be that we're focusing on the cancer or some of these other significant comorbidities. So the bottom line is timing is key, but it doesn't mean that they're all, can happen or can't happen. It's really just having that conversation with the oncologist to talk about when's the best time based on that pet's particular protocol.
Yeah, so definitely another time you want to pick up the phone and really yes. be opening those lines of communications, it sounds like.
Yes, absolutely.
Plums is putting the support you need in one place. Building on 30 years of providing accurate drug information to veterinarians, Plums is branching out to give you day-to-day, patient-to-patient support. With faster search, intuitive navigation, and unprecedented new tools like the Drug Interaction Checker, you'll be prepared for whatever practice brings. Plan on maximum prescribing support at plums.com. So the next two things we're going to talk about are kind of diet and supplements. And I think this is really important because we know from surveys of pet owners that this is something that they are doing with or without our advice. We yes. know that they are getting supplements. We know that they yeah. are changing diets, that they're out there reading, okay? And so they're more likely to feed a home-cooked diet or a raw diet, and they're more likely to use, nutritional supplements in animals with a cancer diagnosis than in healthy animals. So first off, just with nutrition, can you give us a quick refresher on what is cancer cachexia?
Yeah, great question. Cancer cachexia is a metabolic syndrome that's associated with an underlying illness, cancer in this scenario. And it's characterized by the loss of muscle mass with or without the loss of fat. It's really a syndrome that we do not appreciate that often in veterinary medicine. In all actuality, I always joke, we often have pets gaining weight during their treatments. And that's due to the clients feeding them more calories. I lovingly refer to this as a different take on the cancer diet, as and my pet has cancer and they can eat whatever they want, or the seafood diet, whatever they see, they get, right? And so we just don't see this very often, but it's really important to kind of know of that and be aware of it, because we can, occasionally see it in veterinary medicine.
Because it can happen.
Yeah.
And so when you're calculating energy requirements for patients with cancer, is that any different from healthy patients? Do you have to take into account that their metabolism is different?
Yeah, not really. And it's mostly very similar to how we would calculate it in a healthy pet. We should be considering their current body mass index and concurrent comorbidities and discussing those energy requirements. As I mentioned, a lot of them are a little overweight. So we're usually talking about a weight loss program with them and restricting that and feeding more of the RER. But there is some evidence-based medicine on the human side of things related to particular breakdown of a quote-unquote cancer diet or ideal cancer diet. And this relates to research on the Warburg effect. And that is that cancer cells are actually more dependent on glucose than regular cells in the body. And this can result in cancer diets being formulated to have higher quantities of fat and protein and low carbohydrates. So we have a lot of clients coming in and talking about you know, do I need to put my pet on this low carb diet? However, the practical use of such diets in veterinary medicine is contradictory, and the data is pretty inconclusive to date. I also, you know, urge everyone to that's listening that if you have a diet high in fats and proteins, sometimes that can lead to gastrointestinal upset or pancreatitis. So, you know, really ultimately what we're recommending is a well-balanced diet that the pet's going to continue to eat to maintain their weight. And we advise against certain things like, you know, the grain-free options, as we know that that's been linked more recently to cardiac disease, and anything that can complicate our common chemotherapeutics. And one of those would be like doxorubicin, that it in itself has some cardiotoxicity. We don't want to add insult to injury. So sure, we have nuanced conversations, but generally it's, is your pet on a diet? It's eating. Is it maintaining its weight? Is it well-balanced? Great. We're happy.
For those owners that really are insistent on preparing a homemade diet because they're out there, you know, what do you recommend? Do you have a nutritionist that you recommend they work with? I know there's some like online ones, I think from UC Davis, I think the Balance It website and things like that. So
Yeah. A lot of that is kind of what we talked about. And you mentioned this earlier. We know from surveys of owners that clients that have pets diagnosed with cancer are often more interested in feeding their own diet or using these supplements, as you mentioned. And I think that that's really a result of them trying to gain control over an unpredictable disease. I think, you know, their beloved pet's been diagnosed with a disease often associated with heightened emotions. And this is a way that they feel that they can contribute to their pet's cancer treatment. So it's really common that we see this, and a very frequent question we get in the clinics. For those owners that are interested in doing a more homemade diet, we do as just what you said. We recommend that they seek guidance from a veterinary nutritionist and some of those common websites like balanceit.com, because our most important thing is that we want them to receive a well-balanced diet. So it's not that we're opposed to homemade diets. We just want to make sure it's in the pet's best interest. And then, you know, we do strongly advise against raw food diets, and that's only because of the risk of the bacterial translocation, and that may be even higher in our immunocompromised pets, right? So that's really the only homemade diet that we're going to have more strong feelings about. But otherwise, if they're working with a nutritionist or having it balanced and the pet's eating it well, we're pretty happy.
Yeah. I think that is another thing that comes down to communication with the owners. If you can give them a reason, you know, why their animal might be a little bit more susceptible to infection, you know, from a raw diet, they might be a little bit more receptive to that advice, you know?
Sometimes. Sometimes they're pretty set in their way, but we at least document it that we went over it.
So you had briefly mentioned supplements. What are some of the supplements? I'm sure there's lists of supplements that your patients come in on. What are the ones you see most commonly?
Yeah. Every year there seems like there's more and more available on the market. I think this harkens back to what I mentioned before, that clients really want to be a part of their pet's treatment. So they're often, you know, researching this, and companies are getting pretty good at marketing them to particular clients as well. But common supplements that we often hear clients research about prior to consultations with us are things like Unimbio and turkey tail mushroom for our hemangiosarcoma patients. And then there's a newer supplement called Avmaquin that's a sulforaphane supplement. And that's been studied, sulforaphane more commonly on the people side of thing, as either a cancer prevention or potentially in the use with bladder cancers. So that's another one that we commonly are hearing about. And then maybe it's just up here in the Pacific Northwest, but CBD is another, you know, kind of supplement or added medication that people are often asking about or their pets on when they come in.
Sure. And do some of these supplements truly have, you know, immunomodulatory properties or anti-neoplastic properties that have been looked at?
Yeah, there's There's really limited evidence-based medicine on this topic currently. However, each year we are seeing more and more articles related to them. There's a handful of articles related to those two I was talking about with hemangio, Unibio, and turkey tail mushroom. And then in addition, here at OSU, we've been a part of some of the studies with that sulforaphane supplement that we were talking about earlier in cancer management. So I think it's a growing interest for both pet owners and for researchers. So I say, like, watch this space. I think there's more to come, hopefully, in the future years.
Yeah. I think where I have such a hard time when people ask my opinion is that I just don't know how they're going to interact, or if they're going to interact with other things that I already have them on, or that they're already on from their oncologist. Are there any supplements that you strongly caution against because they might interact?
Yeah. We are usually having very nuanced conversations related to this topic with most of our clients. And that's because there's this gap of knowledge of just what you said, the use of them with traditional forms of chemo. You know, there are a few that are out there that have shown that the use of, turkey tail mushroom with standard forms of treatment has not increased the side effects or affected the metabolism of either drugs. But this data isn't really available for all supplements. So we do have those types of nuanced conversations with them. And that's kind of related to, you know, this is our traditional form. This is something that could be added in, but this may affect it. And I can't give you 100% answer. So if you want to be safe, we should probably remove them from these supplements to do traditional forms. But again, anecdotally, I've seen the use of Unibio and turkey tail mushroom and then sulforaphane with it. But I can't tell you with evidence-based medicine that you're not going to have those types of reactions. And the only supplement that, you know, I raise even a certain amount of caution with is that CBD. And that's really related to its inherent proximity to its federally illegal counterpart, marijuana or THC. Mm-hmm. And that's because I think CBD likely has a role in treating certain diseases, that the Eastern and Western medicine working together, the yin and yang. However, production of such products is really not widely regulated. So it's really difficult to know quality control and to know if your patient's receiving true CBD and not, you know, even scant amounts of THC, which we know can be toxic to dogs and cats. So I think it's just something that, again, having those nuanced conversations with clients, and maybe it's a product of being in the Pacific Northwest, but there's some that make their own Rick Simpson oil and CBD. And I'm like, let's, you know, pump the brakes on that, or talk about the risks associated with it. And if, you know, you choose to go that route, that's okay too. But we're gonna say our piece.
Wow. Yeah. So that kind of actually leads in pretty well to our last topic, the last topic of your article and the last topic that we're going to talk about today. And that's how, you know, GPs can be really instrumental in patient monitoring, looking for toxicities, you know, and different adverse drug effects. So what are the most common, we talked a little bit about bone marrow, you know, myelosuppression and things like that. What are the most common hematologic and biochemistry parameters that we need to be looking at in these animals that are undergoing these chemotherapeutic protocols?
Yeah, the most common parameter that we should be monitoring in all chemotherapy patients is the absolute neutrophil count, the platelet count, and the PCV or the hematocrit, either one. And this is because again, those are the cell lines that are affected by most maximum tolerated chemotherapy. That's that innocent bystander effect that I was talking about earlier and how those chemo agents work. Biochemical analysis may also be recommended, but is really more drug dependent. We know that certain drugs are metabolized through the hepatobiliary system. So evaluating the liver function and total bilirubin is really a necessity prior to dosing those types of drugs. And then there's other chemotherapeutics that are excreted nearly unchanged through the kidneys and the urinary system. So knowing that they're properly functioning organs before dosing them is something that we're doing, and oftentimes asking, you know, referring vets to run these analyses beforehand, especially for clients that are traveling hours away, so that they know to get in the car that the pet's, you know, in an acceptable range to be treated. So we're commonly having a partnership with local veterinarians with these. And we try to be very clear in communication of like, hey, we really want a CBC only, or we want a CBC and a full chemistry. And these are the timelines that we're most interested in.
And you're using those not only to like you said, to know whether or not you're going to give chemo, also I would assume dosing. Can you, you know, alter your dosing based on those?
Yeah, potentially. There are certain ones, especially those that we know go through the hepatobiliary system, or dogs kind of similarly who have MDR1 mutations. We may dose our chemotherapeutics differently, because if they sit around in the system longer, they're going to have a higher likelihood of causing side effects. And again, it boils down to our goal of quality of life. So if my intervention is affecting the pet more than their cancer diagnosis, we're going to take a pause and ask if we're doing any good. So we're really trying to minimize those side effects. So potentially it could affect dosing in certain areas.
So if I, as a general practitioner, am working closely with an oncologist and the patient is coming in to me for some, you know, for a CBC prior to chemotherapy, what should make me as a GP like stop and say, hold the phone, you know, not only are you not going to get your chemo, but we're going to keep you in the hospital today.
Yeah. It's a really good question. And it really boils down to, you know, one of the biggest ones is the neutrophil. And that's because the neutrophil has the shortest half-life, and that's anywhere from a couple hours to one day. So it's usually the first cell line that's affected by chemotherapy, and the one that, as oncologists, we're hypervigilant about. The neutrophils typically drop, you know, 5 to 7 days after administration, but can be as early as even a couple days after. And the neutrophil is really important because it's our first line of defense in the body, right? And so it's very vital for keeping our pets safe from translocating bacteria from their oral cavity or their GI tract into their bloodstream, causing sepsis and making them very ill. So if an absolute neutrophil count drops too low, and most oncologists use, you know, below 1,000 neutrophils per microliter, we're going to prescribe prophylactic antibiotics. If the pet's showing clinical signs and has a low neutrophil count, i.e. they have a fever, they're vomiting, they have diarrhea, we're usually going to recommend that those pets be hospitalized with supportive care, IV fluids, IV antibiotics, until we get that neutrophil count back up or them feeling a little bit better, and then kick them out the door as fast as possible, because again, they're immunocompromised. They can pick up stuff in the hospital as well. So it's really trying to play this balance of you know, when can we treat them with oral antibiotics at home where they're kind of in their natural environment versus when do they need to be hospitalized? The other cell lines, you know, like platelets, they have a half-life around 7 to 10 days, and certain drugs may target them a little bit more. I always like to remind everyone, too, that automated cell counts are great, but platelet clumps can make that more challenging. So if you see a low platelet count, remember to do a smear and do a manual count to see if that's actually accurate or not. And then our red blood cells, because their half-life is really around 100 to 120 days, that's usually something that we're going to see chronically over time. It's going to kind of dip as they're going through chemo, but if we're seeing a massive drop or the patient's becoming symptomatic for that, we need to be concerned that there might be another cause. And so those, you know, really we're hyper vigilant and focused on the neutrophils, but those other ones are really important to also be aware of. And again, you know, we're here, we're working as a partnership with you. So any questions, you know, reach out to your local oncologist. We're happy to talk about the different cell lines and what we're really worried about with that particular pet or that particular protocol that they're on.
Sure. Yeah. And then in the article too, you talked about a specific medication. I'm not even going to try to pronounce this. and some dermatologic adverse effects that you could see. So would you mind just summarizing that for the audience?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a unique side effect of a newer chemotherapeutic drug. The brand name's Tenovia, which is way easier to say than raboxifene. So I do not blame you. It's one of those things like you buzzword the students too to ask them to say that appropriately. But Tenovia does have a unique side effect that I think that it was really important to kind of highlight. And that's because the dermatologic toxicity toxicity mimics what looks like a routine hotspot or an ear infection. So because this is a newer drug and a lot of veterinarians may not be aware of it, I just really wanted them to kind of have that on their radar. Because if you see a pet come in that maybe you're not familiar with or don't know their full medical history, and you see this, to ask, hey, are you on a chemotherapeutic? And the reason I say that is because it's not so much the management of those toxicities. It's very similar to how you would manage a hotspot or ear infection. But as oncologists, we would want to know that that side effect happened. Mm-hmm. And that's so that we could do dose reductions or maybe do a treatment delay and maybe start a steroid that can all help with that, so the pet can remain on that drug longer. But when they go in and it's just like, we'll hear that sometimes. They're like, oh, he had an ear infection or had a hot spot in his inguinal region, and we're like, oh wait, when did that happen? Because that could be actually a side effect of this drug. So it was just something that I wanted to highlight. And in the article, I did put a couple pictures of what mm-hmm. some Tenovia reactions look like, and very much it just looks like a hot spot. But they like to for some reason in our pets, at least in the Pacific Northwest, happen a lot in the inguinal region. We'll get it sometimes on their extremities as well. And then, like we said, the ears. It's just kind of a unique side effect of that particular drug.
Yep. And again, just a good reminder at the beginning, go through what medications are you, is your pet on or are you taking?
Yes, yes.
And don't let them say, the answer we always get is, it's in his chart.
Yeah, yeah. Don't you know? Okay. That's what we get all the time. We tell you every week.
Don't you know?
Yeah. Yes.
All right. Well, Dr. Lieber, this has been fantastic. Before I let you go, though, there is a little game that we often play with our guests the end of the podcast. It's so easy. Okay. I don't want you to be worried. It's just a series of would you rather questions. It's just for fun.
Okay.
All right. We'll get started then. So would you rather learn a new skill every year or hone one skill and become the best in the whole world at that one thing?
Oh, wow. I would say, since post-residency and rejoining the human population, the human world, I've got a lot more hobbies in my life. So I think I would like to learn a bunch of different skills. I don't think I would like a spotlight of being like the specialist, the only person who knows how to do something. So
the only one.
Yeah, yep. I think I would prefer just dabbling in all those.
I like to dabble too. No, yeah. I get it. So would you rather to continue to practice but not be able to teach any longer, or to continue to teach but no longer practice?
Oh man, that's like that's like Sophie's Choice, right? I would say, if I'm gonna like answer this, I would say I'd rather practice. And the reason I say that is because a big portion of my specialty every time I go into a room is teaching. I teach the clients about this disease, about what to expect. So I think that's kind of a cop-out because I get to do both. But I would choose continue to practice.
I think the next one hopefully might be a little easier. I don't know.
Oh, no.
Would you rather practice without prednisone or without meropenem? Oh,
no. That's not easy. I would rather practice without prednisone. I think it's a vital drug. It's a tool that we use, but it's usually in combination. And there are mm-hmm. other drugs out there. So even for palliative care for our lymphoma patients, there's a new mm-hmm. oral drug called Laverdia. So we don't have to necessarily rely on Pred alone. And I like to prevent nausea and vomiting as much as possible. So I'm handing out meropenem like candy around here. And so I would hate if I didn't have that. So I'd rather not have Pred.
Okay. Do you abbreviate subcutaneous SC or SQ?
Ooh, I'm an SQ. But I know. It's wrong, but it just makes more sense.
It is. So, all right. Last question. Okay. Would you rather be covered in fur or covered in scales?
Oh gosh, fur. prefer. I'm not much of a fan of scaly creatures. So
reptiles.
Fur.
Yep. I'm gonna go with fur too because it's freezing.
It's
right
free. Yeah.
now.
It's, get a nice little layer.
All right. Well, that was it. See, that wasn't so bad, was it?
Phew. No, not so bad.
Thank you so much again for joining us. This has been just a great conversation, and maybe someday we can have you on again.
Yeah. Thank you again for having me. I really had a good time. I hope everyone learned a little something. And, you know, the article definitely has a lot of good references. So I definitely want to urge everyone to kind of reach out to that. But thank you.
Thanks again to today's guest for joining us. And thank you for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, you can find us wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. While you're there, make sure you subscribe, rate, and review us. You can also listen to our podcast on our website at cliniciansbrief.com/podcasts. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Clinicians Brief and on Instagram at clinicians.brief. Or drop us a line at podcast@briefmedia.com. Clinicians Brief the Podcast is a Brief Media production produced by Alexis Ussery, sound by Randall Stupka, and hosted by me, Dr. Alyssa Watson.